The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I want to start off by making a broad comment about language because I'm always asked about it, and since I will be using words interchangeably, I might as well say something about it. The sort of queer LGBT language issue, and I basically feel in some ways the same today as when I wrote the book with certain tweaks, which is to say that I think language, you know, remains contextual, and at a gathering of Reds, you know, who are somewhat fluent or conversant in LGBT or queer issues, the word queer is certainly readily understood. But among other people, clearly that word remains sort of shunned and for very understandable reasons. And I might add, there's nothing radical about presuming that your entire audience is under the age of 35, lives in an urban area, and went to the university. But I have warmed to it, so I do use them in this talk interchangeably, but it is also worth noting that Generation Stonewall, which is today eligible for Social Security, largely does not use this term. So I'm quite fluid on this question. We'll just say that. So just to dispense with the language issue. I want to start off by saying there's been a debate on the queer left since the explosion of protests in 2008 in the aftermath of California's Prop 8, which, of course, as people here know, denied lesbians and gays the right to equal marriage in the first election that brought Obama to office. In essence, it has been posed as a debate between queer liberation or LGBT rights, and I could not have somehow picked a better week to have this conversation, because I think this conversation is likely to ratchet up again, re-raise itself at a more intense level, for obvious reasons. The Supreme Court decision, that would be the one not denying blacks the right to vote, but the one allowing gays to marry. And in my book, Sexuality and Socialism, which came out a few months after the Prop 8 passed, in time for the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion, in it I took on a sort of unapologetic stance for the tactic of fighting for reforms alongside of others while advancing a much more revolutionary vision of sexuality in society. And I do stand by the political perspective laid out in my book, but since then I've come to believe that many of us on the left are often talking past each other, and that as the reality shifts, our theory also has to rise to some of these new challenges. Some argue that the LGBT movement has lost its way, even moved backward, this is probably best, you know, by pushing for equality demands, civil rights demands, and in fact, there's even a group here out of Chicago that has put up a website called Against Equality. That would be sort of the extreme of that particular argument. Meanwhile, on the right of the movement, and I would place the Human Rights Campaign among them, has a sort of single-minded focus on marriage, winning marriage equality since the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and curiously, or interestingly, or tellingly enough, chose 2012 on the heels of the worst depression since the worst depression to honor, of all people, organizations or institutions, Goldman Sachs, the poster corporation for class inequality, which has now been feted by the wealthiest, most prominent gay rights organization, the HRC, or what many of us call Gay Inc. Sort of re-earns that title every few weeks, doesn't it? This talk is really an attempt to flesh out what I think should be a conversation among radicals with a liberatory sexual vision, and not simply about LGBT rights under capitalism, but I'd like to take this discussion perhaps a little bit further. And in it, I'd like to do essentially three things. One, advance our understanding of the contradiction of reforms under capitalism. Secondly, to talk about what is changing about the nature of the system 30 years into the ruling class's successful neoliberal offensive. And lastly, discuss whether or not capitalism still needs homophobia and transphobia in order to function into the coming era. All of those questions, and I'm sure much more else will come up. First, let me reiterate very briefly my starting point, which is that LGBT rights, such as same-sex marriage, are civil rights that must be unapologetically defended by socialists and other leftists, not only for their own sake as material and social benefits under capitalism, especially to working class and poor LGBT people, but because reform is not a barrier. It's not a barrier to further struggles, but actually can often be a gateway to them instead, sort of the gateway drug to revolution. Socialists and other leftists defend strikes for higher pay and better health care, despite the fact that even complete and total victory means renegotiating the terms of exploitation, not ending the wage system itself. Radicals are almost always at the forefront of anti-war movements, demanding immediate withdrawal of all troops from this or that country, and an end to occupation, despite the fact that the U.S. empire would continue to maintain some 700 plus bases in countries around the world. So leftists take these stands for reforms because we understand that the capitalist system and its imperial might is not going to end in one fell swoop. Reformist struggles can create the organizational and human material necessary for further transformation of society. Moreover, I think it does make a difference in the here and now whether workers have more pay or couples, regardless of sexual orientation, have more rights. I might also add, perhaps this is obvious, but it ought to be stated, the left is really rarely consulted before masses take to the streets over this or that issue, so it's not as though it's up to us. So I think that might have been what Marx meant about, you know, we do not make revolutions in conditions of our own choosing. It's also worth noting that the leading queer activists during the historical marker all of us on the left look to as the high point of gay struggle, which it would be the late 60s and then the 1970s, often called for full equality under the law, even as they put forward a far more revolutionary worldview and named themselves after the enemy of U.S. imperialism, right? The Gay Liberation Front, of course, took its name from the National Liberation Front, which was the Viet Cong, the people who the U.S. government were fighting. And even in the more modern era, around ACT UP, which again has sort of been revitalized historically because of the new films that have come out about them. And, when I think about one of the oddest, most perverse chants I've ever heard in my life, it was led by ACT UP back when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was first initiated under the Clinton administration. I believe it was outside the Times Square recruitment station, and it was 2, 4, 6, 8, we kill, we maim, we decorate. Not exactly a revolutionary chant. I was somewhat ambivalent about this chant, because I don't kill, I don't maim, and I frankly don't decorate. But it is to say that in the high points of the the queer movement, that this has been seen at various times as a tactic that is worth fighting for. Yet while many gays and lesbians now live with freedoms inconceivable just one generation ago, in which our sexual orientation is not in any way for some of us a barrier in our day-to-day lives, it is also undeniable that this gain is not universally enjoyed by all gays and lesbians, nor has it been meant gains for most trans people in this country. Certainly gay men, in particular white gay men, have gained more than even lesbians, arguably, given the realities of sexism in our society, and those in stable relationships, if those things exist, have gained in ways, I read about them in books, I see them in movies, I'm told I may have one day. I hope my girlfriend is not listening to this talk. that these people have gained in ways that single queers or those who are in non-monogamous relationships have not. In addition, queer people of color experience what some scholars have come to refer to as a sort of double invisibility. That is, that they are ignored at best inside of the dominant white gay culture due to racism, and yet remain less visible as queers, at least, in many black and brown communities, though not all. So the sort of civil rights framework, I think we do have to admit, as revolutionaries, does pose a challenge to us on the left. Not because the demand for equality is wrongheaded, but because of the contradictory nature of reforms under capitalism. We must have basic civil rights to live in the world as it is while we fight to challenge it and to change it. But winning those rights does, to some degree or other, further entrench queers, or if you prefer the word, normalize, the system that crushes us, right? So I think, in my opinion, this is a conundrum built into the system, not into the demand. I really actually like the way the Canadian queer scholar and activist Alan Sears, who was also a socialist, sums it up in a talk he gave at Historical Materialism back in 2011, in a talk called Sex After Marriage, like the talk title. This is how he put it, I'll quote him. "The idea that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered politics boil down to a choice between assimilation and transgression revolves around a moralistic call to queerness. This is not supple enough for understanding the ways people negotiate their everyday lives in relation to projects for change. As Sheila Rowbotham wrote back in 2001, and he's quoting her, there are no easy answers to the question of how you live in a world you want to change radically. And he goes on to say, those of us who believe in radical change are caught between the actual world we live in and the places we want to go. And I'll end with this part. A moral exhortation to abandon the world and live prefiguratively outside of society can lead to personal and political isolation." I think that sums up the conundrum very, very eloquently. And it articulates, in my opinion, the politics of radical queers who've rejected involvement with the equal marriage and other LGBT civil rights struggles by dismissing the demand for equal rights as either too narrow or even reactionary, as the sort of against equality folks are. Much of the self-identified left queer cadre in this country has stood aside as hundreds of thousands of queers in the country have moved into activity. Rather than join with others in pushing for the demand and raising the wider political questions and demands alongside of the minority of us who got involved with liberatory politics, the sort of anti-equality queers, or perhaps the post-equality queers, I don't know, abandoned this field of battle and lost an opportunity to capture a wider audience for more transformative demands. And in the context of a leftward shifting consciousness, I consider this a real tactical error on their part. And I look to, like, there's this example in a book I really enjoy by Claiborne Carson about the history of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, in which Carson cites a quote from Diane Nash, who in the early part of the 60s, as she enters the sort of civil rights part of the black movement, says, you know, her dream, her aspirations, her perspective at that moment was that one day a black man will invent a nuclear weapon. You know, and by the end of that decade, she's like, black power, revolution! You know, it's like, people don't necessarily end up where they begin. Thank God for all of us in so many ways. And effectively, I think this served to help, in other words, the abandonment of the struggle by people with a much more liberatory vision, I think in some ways served to help elevate Gay Inc.'s voice and perspective in this movement. Whether or not the collective voices of queer leftists inside of the struggle could have shifted the tide, I honestly can't say. I mean, this is a question that cannot be answered. I do know it was rather isolating for those of us who were among the small handful of leftist queers with a broader liberatory vision, who found ourselves for the last several years squeezed between a hostile anti-equality queer left on the one side and a really hostile and well-funded anti-liberationist Gay Inc. on the other. I think we can locate the source of our disagreement, theoretically, in our different conceptions of power and the state. Queer scholar Lisa Duggan has popularized the term homonormativity to describe the assimilation of large layers of queer people into the existing middle class sort of straight social order. Though I think it's a really catchy term to describe very real phenomenon, theoretically, I think it's flawed in the way it approaches the question. It seems to place the weight on personal decisions and lifestyle choices rather than structural constraints that shape and distort all of our sexualities, including those of straight people. So in my opinion, it winds up coming off as sort of moralistic and not political. As Marxists, we have a different concept. Power is not some rootless, ubiquitous, vague notion. Power emanates from control over production and the social relations that make production possible. By locating the source of power in the state and in the class in whose interest the state functions, that is to say, the ruling class, Marxists see challenging power not as the task of individual lifestyle choices, but of collective agency, which is, just from our vantage point, class struggle being the most potent form of that collective struggle. Now, despite the absence of an overt sort of class critique of homonormativity, the term does get at a very real problem of the sort of bourgeoisification of the LGBT movement. Just as I believe Jasper Puar and her concept of homo-nationalism does when it draws on this concept in the sort of global arena. Homo-nationalism describes the consciousness of a layer of gays and lesbians who identify with Western states and values as liberators of queer people from supposedly kind of backward, medieval-minded Arabs and Muslims, for example, in Palestine, the sort of pinkwashing campaign being first among them. And, you know, and of course, perversely enough, you know, queer rights are now used by Israel and Zionists worldwide to justify the occupation of Palestine. You know, homo-nationalists are sort of getting sucked into an imperialist ideology that tries to lay claim to gay rights as a sort of marker of civilization, as if secular humanism were somehow an imperial value. I want to get back to something I said earlier about the limitations of equality under capitalism. I said that the conundrum lies in the system and not in the demand. The capitalist state exists within a broader system of inequality and commodification. We all know what inequality is, and we live it every day, but it's less clear what commodification in the Marxist sense of the term means. First, a commodity is something that is produced for the purpose of exchanging for something else, usually money, like a car or a shoe, whatever is made. Commodification means the transformation of human relationships into commercial relationships, relationships of exchange, of buying, of selling. Even sex under capitalism is commodified. A human relationship, arguably the most intimate of all human relationships, is transformed under capitalism into a commercial relationship. It's used to sell beer, for example, or it can be bought and sold, that is, sex work or prostitution or pornography. And when I say this, I'm not making a value judgment about those things, just sort of stating a factual relationship that arises out of capitalism. So sex has been transformed into a commodity to be bought and sold on the market or used to sell other things on the market, and our sexualities are commodified, that is, our sexualities are converted, are coveted or shunned on the basis of their marketability. Bizarrely enough, the success of the LGBT struggles over the last 40 years has actually transformed our sexuality from a sort of marginalized outlier status to being highly marketable. We had no intention of doing this, of course, but we created a new market. Now, Marx looked at ways in which commodities are fetishized. He didn't quite mean it the way we sometimes mean it. He He described how we attribute mystical powers to commodities, and in that sense, that has a lot in common, which after all are sort of made by human beings, and yet the actual human bodies that produce commodities are themselves degraded by the actual labor process. All of the sort of cultural doodads of queerness, you know, the fashion, the booze, the sort of style, are fetishized. That is, that they are transformed in our minds and on the market into wonderful, transformative things. And because our lives and our bodies are filled with mindless drudgery, you know, you got to do the laundry and you got to pick up the kids and you got the groceries, oh, I forgot the half and half, you know, not exactly sexy stuff there. We actually wind up aspiring to become like these commodities. It is the origin of our own alienation under capitalism. The things that we humans actually create come to rule over us, and they're just so much sexier than we are. I mean, look at an Absolute bottle. They really are. The commodification of lesbian gay sexualities has been contradictory. On the one hand, we opened up a space for ourselves. That's good. As a result of struggles that have led to more and more people coming out of the closet and others experimenting with sexual practices that would have been unthinkable in a previous era. Corporate America has in fact now embraced the gay market, as we know all too well. This weekend's gay pride parades are festooned with Miller Lite, which we know is delivering our liberation alongside of Citibank. So, for example, there's not only the expansion of gay bars and clubs and tourism and porn, etc., but there's been a transformation of gay into a marketable commodity, a sensibility that is lean, usually white, conventionally attractive, well-dressed, well-coiffed, sweet-smelling, well-decorated, with impeccable bourgeois style. Nothing embodies this more than that show Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I mean, if it hadn't been existed, you know, I would have made a joke. I would have caricatured. It's a caricature of all of this. The invention of the metrosexual, right? The straight men who are expected to be as obsessed with their appearance and grooming as women is a sort of marker of this evolution. Such as it is. But naturally, the market only embraces those images that can be deemed desirable, which is to say, sellable. So black bodies, brown bodies, fat bodies, those bodies that don't conform to heterosexual gender norms, disabled bodies, all of these kinds of other bodies are all left out of the gay embrace, so to speak, just as they are with straight people. So on the one hand, gay men and lesbians who can afford a certain lifestyle and image are no longer pariahs. Yet the price of entry is rather costly, as we know. One must have the health status, the education, the financial well-being, and the appearance to be fully accepted. And those without those qualities are rejected, and under conditions of a neoliberal state, even further oppressed, policed, vilified, and victimized. That is what drives the queer left's totally understandable dismissal of assimilation into what is referred to as the heteronormative world, but what I prefer to call bourgeois society. In Marxist terms, a term already existed. In Marxist terms, gays and lesbians are now welcome to be visible as consumer subjects, but not social subjects. I want to talk about the shifts under neoliberalism, because I think that some of the best writing on how to theorize our way through this conundrum has come from Rosemary Hennessy in her book Profit and Pleasure, from Alan Sears, who I mentioned before, in his writings on queer anti-capitalism and other writings on the lean state, and actually in the transgender reader, whose editor is Susan Stryker. Throughout much of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and through the mid-20th century, the American ruling class, along with other Western ruling classes, sought to regulate the social behaviors and habits of the working class. The temperance movement banned alcohol in some places or severely restricted its hours and venues of consumption. Activities like gambling and prostitution were outlawed and continue, of course, to be shamed. And if you think about it, the creation of free public schools and in countries outside of the United States, which would be the civilized world, the establishment of national health care allowed for what some scholars call a social citizenship. That is, a means of inclusion for at least some parts of the working class to attain a common standard of health, literacy, and even a common nationalist outlook that you get from public school. Of course, this social citizenship was always partial and it was always discriminatory. Capitalism has always been racialized, it's always been classed, and it's always been gendered. even during the height of the welfare state and the expansion of the welfare state. So, for example, we had formal segregation. Immigrants have always been highly regulated, and women have always been expected to bear the burden of housework, even once they entered the workforce in mass numbers. The poor have always been segregated into the deserving poor, which is, say, widows and orphans, and the non-deserving poor, like blacks and women who have children out of wedlock. But with shifts in the market toward privatization and deregulation are the sort of most visible markers of neoliberalism, cultural and moral shifts followed. Social citizenship has been jettisoned under neoliberalism for a sort of do-it-yourself ethic. And along with that has come deregulated culture. And here again is how Alan Sears puts it. He says, the shift from the broad welfare state to new forms of social policy has produced a limited moral deregulation. The state has given up a few of the tools it used to attempt to shape the morality of the population. Social policy through much of the 20th century sought to inculcate values of temperance and prudence among working class people. Yet these values can be an impediment to working class consumerism and market-oriented hedonism. The shift towards the market has seen various forms of deregulation, ranging from the legalization of gambling to reductions in censorship. And he goes on to talk about some of these things and says, the recognition of certain lesbian and gay rights in this situation of moral deregulation is thus rather parallel to the legalization of gambling through casinos and lotteries and the deregulation of trucking. He ends with, the state has withdrawn from certain areas of regulatory control and turned them over to the amoral market. And it's easy to see how the sort of neoliberal state has whittled away at our social and economic expectations, right? Our jobs have become more precarious, benefits are slashed, we're put into this sort of global race to the bottom. We know all of this. And in the end, our expectations of the state delivering anything at all have been smashed. And this is one of the things that has given rise, obviously, to Occupy and some of the social movements that are rising today. But on the sexual front, neoliberalism's impact is a little less clear. We Marxists have always argued that the roots of women's and gays' oppression can be found in capitalism's drive to privatize social reproduction. That is, the need for the system to foist social needs, right, like housework, cooking, raising children, or in their view, you know, the next generation of workers, which is what children are, onto the privatized family. And the nuclear family is a sort of contradictory phenomenon, right? It can be both an emotional sanctuary or a hell, and simultaneously a privatized means of providing social needs, like providing the current and next generation of workers. And gay historian John D'Amelio has talked about this at length. I won't have time to cite him. I want to move on. But prior to the neoliberal offensive, there was a much more defined sexual division of labor in the workplace. Mass production methods with the greater physical demands allowed for much more sort of regulated, gendered division of labor. Masculinity could be equated not just with earning a family wage, but the ability to endure great pain, long hours, grueling work in a factory, for example. The types of jobs for women were often justified on the basis of women's supposed frailty and the expectation that women would periodically leave the workforce to give birth and raise kids. But with the technological changes alongside of all the social shifts that have created ideological changes, not the least of which is the women's liberation movement in this country, there's been a breakdown in those old divisions. The rise of this service sector economy has reconfigured the old sexual divisions of labor. The neoliberal do-it-yourself ethos means women are expected to both raise children and do the housework and cleaning and work incredibly long hours and figure out some way on their own with a partner, if they have one, to, you know, take care of kids and do all the things that need to happen. You know, you are on your own. As with the assault on reproductive rights, capital is sort of readjusting our expectations down to subterranean levels and making us all more vulnerable. With the attacks on reproductive rights, it's not so much that capital expects half of its workforce, which is female and of childbearing age, to leave and reproduce an endless number of children. That's not really the expectation, in my opinion. Eliminating access to abortion would be highly disruptive to capital. It's that the ruling class wants to heighten the degree of vulnerability and control and eliminate any expectation whatsoever that the state is there to ease women's burden. The attacks on entitlements are obviously all part of the shift. The body aesthetic of neoliberalism conforms to its productive needs. So the lean production strips everything down to its barest elements, right? You have just-in-time production. They don't have warehouses of stuff, you know, made ahead of time. Everything is done, to the bone. Lean production has its corollary in lean bodies as the cultural gold standard. It's no surprise that a layer of gay men, in particular, embody this aesthetic ideal, combined with gay men's understandable reaction to being pathologized through the AIDS crisis. It's not surprising that many of them have come to see lean and muscular, hyper-masculine bodies to be a sort of retort to that pathologization. And gay male social standards now conform to neoliberalism's social demands. Even as the lives of working people have become more sedentary, and that sort of social ideal, aesthetic ideal, has become near impossible for most people to achieve. And along with neoliberalism's flexible workforce requirements has come a devastating level of punishment and surveillance. So this is where we see most acutely the stark limitations of gaining LGBT civil rights under capitalism. At the same time that the nation's largest workforce, the military, ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and equal marriage rights are now here and appear to be on heading to a state near you, right? We're seeing a rise in violence against gender nonconforming men and women, as well as an entrenched criminalization of transgenders. Trans people have to contend with the state's surveillance of their gendered bodies. Toby Beauchamp, who is a legal scholar, has, I think, advanced this discussion in his writings about the medical and psychiatric monitoring of trans people. He argues that central to the standardized definition of trans identity is the expectation that trans people will, through the process of transitioning, eliminate all references to their birth gender and essentially disappear into a normatively gendered world. Trans people must pass. They must blend in. In their own words, they must go stealth. Medical science relies on a sort of standardized, normalized, gendered presentation. Therefore, monitoring trans people's ability to pass seamlessly as non-trans. Gender deviance must be concealed. And it's not just about erasing transgender status. It also necessitates altering one's gender presentation to conform with white, middle-class, able-bodied, heterosexual understandings of normative gendering. The consequences of not doing so are obviously deadly. On the same day when NBA player Jason Collins made history by coming out as the first openly gay male athlete still playing the sport, basketball, the third black trans woman was murdered that month alone in the state of Ohio, brutalized, mutilated, and killed. The medical establishment's promotion of concealment of trans status works to actually reestablish the norm. Thus, in legal cases dealing with violence against gender-variant individuals, the claim that is often worked to exonerate trans bashers, people who have actually gotten off from these killings, by basically claiming that the root cause of the violence was the trans person's dishonest concealment of their true sex, quote unquote. Just as the neoliberal state monitors our emails and phone calls to potentially criminalize or to get the goods on any of us, just as the neoliberal state monitors the nation's borders not to stop the flow of immigration but to control it and immiserate the conditions of labor, so too it monitors gender borders quite closely in order to control, confine, and define acceptable gender behavior. This tells us something about how important the gender division of labor remains under capitalism. The ability to pay women less than men for the same exact work, the expectation of free, largely female labor in the home, the dependence on disciplining society through gender expectations remains at the root of this sort of gender border patrol. What's more, the heightened commodification of bourgeois gay and lesbian sexuality has equated gay with rich or high status in many people's minds. You think of Will and Grace, you think of all the sort of pop culture references. And it actually allows a sort of, in the midst of this sort of crisis that we are undergoing, an economic crisis that is not going to turn around anytime soon or perhaps never under this system, we are seeing a sort of diversion of class anger in some places, including Greenwich Village, against queers themselves as a sort of marker of bourgeoisification in some people's minds, whether that particular individual is upper class or not. In fact, the most famous gay killing in this country, that of Matthew Shepard, is an example of this itself. Right? The two felt, it's not to excuse it, but we have to have a political understanding of why these killings happen, right? The two people who killed Matthew Shepard, two 21-year-olds, Aaron McKinney, Russell Henderson, were from the trailer park. One of them was actually a very good student. Which one? Henderson, I think, one had aims to go off to college, was an A student, couldn't afford it, became a roofer, earned $12,000 a year. Both of them had mothers who were murdered. One died in the midst of a hysterectomy, the other one was murdered on her way home from a bar one night. Again, not to excuse them, not to sort of, oh, poor killers, but this has a social context. And Matthew Shepard, who had actually paid for their drinks at the bar prior to them killing him, was seen as a rich, white, gay man. He was seen as part of the class problem. And so when we understand this, it seems impossible to sort of disentangle the sort of homophobic rage that some people have from the wider economic and social context in which it occurs. I want to end with a brief note about whether or not, I think at least, capitalism still needs homophobia. It forces itself into the discussion today, doesn't it? And I think we have to ask ourselves, does it mean that because capitalism has created and made use of heteronormativity, that homophobia is necessary for capitalist production? It seems that we're witnessing in the modern era is that capitalism does not require heteronormative families or even necessarily a gendered division of labor. What it does require is an unequal division of labor, and it requires divisions within the working class in order to divert class anger. If gays and lesbians are willing to shore up that unequal division, whether that means running corporations or feeding their families or raising children or caring for the elderly, capital will accept us. This limited acceptance is not just a freestanding sort of cultural phenomenon any more than the emergence of sort of new families includes, all non-nuclear arrangements. Yes, heteronormativity's dependence on gender differences continues to bolster an unequal division of labor in the home and in the marketplace, and the ideology of the nuclear family shields an unpaid domestic labor force, whether straight or gay. But claiming a queer identity can actually participate in the same cultural logic. I want to sort of end with this, because I think we can't de-link sexuality from its historical connection to the human relationships of exploitation that capitalism relies on. So, in asking the question, does capitalism still need homophobia? Yes, but not in the same old way. Capitalism needs an unequal division of labor, and it needs to pit us against each other. But capitalism, just like sexuality, sex, and gender, is also fluid. It's also plastic. It takes different forms, and so long as profit can be made, capitalism is perfectly capable of shifting certain norms. It will look different in different places and at different times. And we cannot overstate these shifts as if they are sort of universally enjoyed and applicable. The fact is, homophobia is here and used and ubiquitous in this country. And in a few places, in particular in cosmopolitan centers and among middle-class enclaves and in corporate America, gays and lesbians who present themselves as acceptably, if we will, heteronormative, will be accepted. And everybody else will be shat on, as it is with straight people. So, in my opinion, to dismiss the advances in gay rights as insufficient is to dismiss the road we may need to take to travel to get to liberation, and to dismiss the real life needs queers have today. 60% of trans people live in poverty. It is estimated that 20% of all murders in this country are murders of transgender people. Gay men like Tyler Clementi are still throwing themselves off of bridges out of shame and torment. So please do not tell me that when two NFL players write letters in support of gay marriage, it's reactionary or irrelevant. That is not the world we live in. Saying this, real human beings make revolutions, not abstractions. If we cannot live today, we cannot fight tomorrow.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.